utmost time for music for human beings, where nothing nasty will take place for the next hour, so you should make sure not to change the station in any way, shape, or form. A couple of events of radical interest taking place in the coming week that we're going to tell you about. And I'll start here. The coalition of, I never know how to pronounce this, Immokalee workers is on tour with their new exhibit, the Modern Day Slavery Museum. The exhibit will be traveling around the Northeast for the next few weeks and will be in Boston next Monday, August the 9th, which of course is Nagasaki Day. The centerpiece of the museum exhibit is a box truck outfitted as a replica of the trucks used to enslave tomato pickers in a brutal case that was prosecuted in federal court in 2008. The truck was developed in consultation with workers who have escaped from slavery operations, as well as leading academic authorities on labor history and the subject of forced labor. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers, who work with farm workers down in Florida, has aided the Department of Justice in the prosecution of six farm worker slavery operations, leading to the liberation of over 1,000 workers. The truck and the accompanying multimedia exhibit look at the history of forced labor, why it continues to occur, and the solution that's being forged to pull slavery up by its roots, as they say. So the museum, which is a truck, will stop in Boston this coming Monday at City Hall Plaza in Boston from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. The event is free and open to the public. They also offer special tours for groups and organizations. For more information, visit the Coalition of Immokalee Workers website, ciw-online.org. And Comrade Mark is here. You have one, too.
Yes. This Sunday at 11 a.m., the Community Church of Boston Sunday Speakers Forum will present its annual Hiroshima-Nagasaki commemoration on George's Island. If you'd like to attend, people will gather at the Long Wharf North Pier right next to Columbus Park at 10:30 a.m. to get on the 11 a.m. ferry to George's Island. Tickets can be purchased beforehand or at the pier. Everyone is encouraged to bring food to share and other picnic-related things. There will be a short service calling for a world free of nuclear weapons. Visit www.bostonharborislands.com to learn more about the islands and ferry tickets. And for more information about the Community Church of Boston, visit www.communitychurchofboston.org or call 617-266-6710.
Okay, I can't do any more of this blast furnace stuff, so we'll talk over this now. One more, real quick. The Impression for Change, the 35th anniversary poster show of Red Sun Press, is showing for the final time at the Harriet Tubman House in the South End, now through August 27th. This retrospective chronicles the history of political activism in Boston from the 1970s to the present. Red Sun Press is a worker-owned printing and graphic design company in Jamaica Plain dedicated to social justice. The Harriet Tubman House is located at 566 Columbus Ave, corner of Mass Ave in Boston. Visit redsunpress.coop for more info. And now we are out of time. We're going to make space for music. Music for human beings. And for the human beings that make the music for human beings, who will be floating in anon. So the views and opinions expressed on this program have been those of the participants and not necessarily the staff and management of WMBR, the Technology Broadcasting Corporation, or MIT. I will be back next week. I hope you will be too. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to WMBR in Cambridge. Stay tuned for human beings and the music thereof.
مرحباً بكم. Yes, مرحباً. I'm a Dr. Jalis Sakran, and I do welcome you. The waves of radiance beat down upon me on this warm, deliciously warm, somewhat uncomfortably warm day. For those of you who have never felt warmth, it can be stifling. And today, I'm pleased to be stifled by two co-hosts. We welcome Aurora.
Namaste, and thank you again for this beautiful somnolence. And I would like to state that everyone at some point has felt some warmth, be it physical or mental or spiritual. And there is no one whose entire existence has been without and within, bleak and cold.
And there are those who are so stifled by affection that they wish that they were in a void of community. The ancient philosopher Xuanggu stated about affection that it was like a bath. Too great affection, the water would grow uncomfortably warm, steam would rise, and one could suffocate. Too little affection, the water would freeze, and one is trapped within the coldness of one's own existence. Xuanggu, a very much tangible analogies, physical, concrete analogies.
And indeed, this is great wisdom, for we find ourselves in a period of time where our baths are just the perfect temperature, the perfect balance between warm and cold, and we can splash it with pure happiness in the same way that we splash with the affection of those around us.
Well, Aurora, of course, it is lovely to have you. Let us also welcome Professor Levine and splash him. Professor, welcome.
Whoa, that was quite a splash, Dr. Jalis. But I must say that as a child myself, I never felt that a bath was too hot. I always wanted the water to be hotter and hotter. And as far as I know, there is no limit to the warmth and heat that I desired in my childhood bath time.
And yet, does not the bubbling water blister your fair skin?
No, it never did, and I wonder if there is a limit to the warmth and affection that a precocious young Jewish child can take. But I myself think that in our current day and age, affection is more like a bubble bath. Many bubbles. The bubbles represent all the images that the media give to us. Sometimes they're nice bubbles, sometimes they're poison bubbles, but there are many bubbles.
And yet this is a terrifying image, for the affection itself is clouded, or it is clouding. From our true selves, we cannot see.
That's right. The bubbles have a sort of distorting effect, so that it is very hard to actually directly perceive the affection of another anymore. Instead, all that we perceive is mediated by all the images that television and movies have burned into our brains.
And I wonder if it is not possible, even though the bubble is not quite as volatile, has not quite the temperature of steam, is it still not possible to asphyxiate on bubbles?
Death by bubble.
I've often had fear of consuming various candies and gelatinous caramels because I feared that my mouth and nose would become stopped up.
Well, I suppose if one were to drop a few grams of anthrax powder into bubble bath solution, that would possibly create a very luxurious style of death.
Perhaps this chewing of soft candies is an analogy to affection, to happiness, which when consumed in too large a quantity can stop our mouths and prevent us from expressing ourselves, from making those noises that are us.
I like these noises. I think these noises are someone, not us, but someone who is producing them. They are a genuine expression of the self, and
a joyful.
I find these expressions are all too rare nowadays. We're often, we say things that we believe must be heard by others, that others must accept, instead of just purely expressing ourselves out of joy. Ba-ba-ba. Ba-ba-ba.
Aurora, what is your take on this vocal form?
Well, let us take a pause for a second to absorb it, and then I will tell you my analysis. This is very interesting. You see that the ear loves and enjoys this expression because it is not pure joy. If it were pure joy, it would be saccharine to our ears. There is some pain behind the singer, but it is a soft pain that is mitigated by years of concentration, which has led to now a very joyful and a very mellow and a very centered individual.
Yes, I see a bit of joyful euphoria in this style, and I think I've often myself tried to live a life full of euphoria, but I found it difficult because the euphoria must be balanced, and our normal counterweight to euphoria is sadness.
But also, I think that even if our life is full of happiness, the wise person or the person with the blessed soul might be visited by sadness in the dream. The dream, of course, not being constrained by the rules of normal existence, may serve to deliver a lesson or a new vision about a life that one does not have, and so one may appreciate or fear the life that one currently lives.
I think movies can sometimes have this effect as well. Fiction, books, anytime we get to experience through our powers of imagination the life of some other being, some other human or other life form, we get to appreciate more the life that we do live.
Indeed, to achieve a deeper sense of self, one that is not achievable in one lifetime.
And at the same time, though, reading these stories and becoming engrossed in these fiction, I found myself today reading a story as I traveled on the T, and I found myself being the person I was reading about. I find myself understanding her so intimately that it was almost as if I was her, and I began to cry from her pain and from her joy. And from that life, which I had not known that I had until then. And so as you learn of yourself, so can you also learn about those around you, and you can reach out beyond yourself. And sometimes you can lose yourself in reaching out and becoming yet another person.
Indeed, we are all similar. We all live under one moon.
But we do not all feel the same experiences. We do not all have the same little dents in our souls that arise from experiences and shape who we are, that give us our individuality, as temporary as it may be.
Well, I do think that as one discovers more about themselves, as one becomes self-reflective and contemplative, then one is able to change the way you are also, because once you're aware of an attribute, you can then decide this attribute must be altered in some way because it does not reflect my true soul. Mm. It is some cruft, some layer of crust that has grown over my true self. But until one recognizes those things, it's impossible to change them.
I think in Aurora's view, this would be regarded as a determined re-experiencing of previous experiences so that one may reflect and have an opportunity to interpret the events of one's life repeatedly.
Right, but also by inhabiting the shoes of another human, be it through a dream or remembered memories from a previous existence in life, One can begin to reflect upon the differences between oneself and those other beings and discover new facts about oneself and therefore allow oneself to change. So this is actually the power of fiction and human imagination that we're talking about.
And it can also, I believe, enhance the empathy and allow ourselves to really feel the true network, the true unity, the commonness of experience and of the range of emotions that we feel. This is fake. Perhaps we do not all feel the same way, but it allows us to feel as though we are unified and more attached to others.
Yes, I myself have the meditative practice of inhabiting the shoes in my mind of a person from a single continent every week. Mm. So I have a sort of 7-week rotation
between the various continents.
That's right, yeah.
Now, and have you ever attempted to be two people at the same time, like the right half being someone in Asia and the right half in South America, for example?
I tried that once. I started, but I noticed myself slipping into psychosis, sort of dual personality. I sort of was starting to lose my sense of the unity of itself, and so I had to stop.
Now, I think this is an important point that you make, Professor Levine, a general point, which is that if we regard our existences as being determined by two things, one, our biological material, and the other, the experiences that we have had, the environment that we have been created in, that it seems that we are simply victims of our own life. But the point that you make about the opportunity that we have to reinterpret the lives that we have led and the possibility of exploring others' existences, these imply that we also have some control over the experiences that we choose to have and how we choose to absorb what we have lived through. So one small example is that a person may be listening to the program and think, this is an experience which I will have. But it is also possible to call the program and modify the experience.
For oneself and for us.
And for us and for others.
One can have a strong effect on us.
How would one go about calling the program and affecting the universe?
There is a device. There is a device called the telephone. And if one were to activate the device and to enter the following string of digits, then it is possible to connect and influence and be influenced.
And what is that string of numbers?
The number is 617-253-8810.
Yes, I remember the days of the rotary telephone, where one would have to manually turn a dial around and let it swing back.
A previous life of mine that I have recently accessed in a bath, coincidentally. She remembers, she was a woman, actually, but she remembers picking up the phone and just yelling out a name, and there would be so many women and men on the other phones in the neighborhood, and all of them connected to one another, just listening, hoping for some gossip.
Hmm.
All of the lines connected, and part of me misses that greatly, the fact that you could have an enormous conversation with almost no effort and reach out to those around you.
Yes, the village life is no longer with us in the Western world, but it does raise an interesting point to my mind. I've been reading recently about sleep. The fact that we human beings, we need sleep, and we need different phases of sleep. And perhaps a sleeping person now is calling us.
Well, let's try to connect to them.
It does sound indeed like a sleeping phone.
Yes, sleep calling is a dangerous activity. But anyway, sleep. So I discovered that apparently sleep is conducted in different ways in different cultures of the world and in different types of civilizations. In the Western world here, where we have artificial light, we tend to go to sleep rather late in the night and sleep in one intense segment of 6, 7, 8 hours. Whereas in pre-industrial societies, people live in villages without electricity. They tend to structure their sleeping habits in a very different way. As soon as the sun sets, people will start going to bed. And then the caller strikes again.
Let's try it. Caller, marhaban. Caller?
Hello.
Yes, welcome, caller.
I'm sorry?
Welcome to the air, caller.
Oh.
Ah, giggle. Was that a nervous giggle?
Caller, are you still with us?
I think we may have lost the caller due to excitement. Let's try another caller. Caller 2, marhaban.
Hello.
Welcome, caller.
Hi, how are you guys tonight?
We are well, caller. Thank you. How are you?
I'm well. I just wanted to say that sometimes I feel as though I'm living in two places at once. So right now I'm working down at Logan Airport, but at the same time I feel as though I have another person in my head who is traveling in the Amazon.
Mm. And what does this give you? Do you feel a connection?
I do. I feel like it's two people in one.
Mm.
There's an adventurous side of myself, and then there's an average person who's working hard down at the airport.
And it is glorious that this adventurous person can at will be transported to the most exotic places. And do you find that this non-physical spiritual travel is enough to quench the traveling desire of this inner person?
Well, I think it depends on, again, goes back to the power of imagination and thought and projection. Of course, as children, we're all very capable of this sort of activity where our physical self would be in one place, mm. and yet our mind would be placing ourselves in some other fantastical universe. I myself, when I used to walk on the sidewalks going from one place to another in my childhood neighborhood, I would put my hand out sort of horizontally, so my hand would be flat and gliding along as I stepped. And I would think of my hand as a spaceship.
And there is something about the child mind that permits one to have such diverse and wonderful imaginings. Caller, tell us about your other self? What is... does this other self have a distinct personality other than a distinct setting?
He's a bit more brave than my actual self. For example, he'll travel to the jungle without a care, just him and his machete, down the Amazon River.
And is he satisfied with the spiritual journey, or does he attempt to tempt you away from your job?
Well, I do wish I had more time to be a more adventurous person. So that may be it, you know?
Mm. Do you believe that it may be a part of you trying to fulfill a dream that has been dormant within you?
That's possible.
I mean, why? What is preventing you from exploring this more fully?
I couldn't tell you. I mean, it just happens. I just think it up in my mind, you know?
That is so well stated. There are so many parts of our life that if we stepped back and we thought about it, those actions that we take would make very little sense. And yet they fulfill our desires. They make us understand ourselves in a special way.
Hmm. Yes, and I think this goes back to the way we live our lives in modern Western society. We're so busy all the time. We have our jobs, and we have our telephones, speaking of which.
Yeah, let's bring another voice in to share it with us. Caller, marhaban.
Hello?
Caller, welcome.
Yeah, hi, this is Scott from Cambridge. I just wanted to grab an airplane pilot for a minute and ask if there were, like, lost worlds in the Amazon that, not necessarily prehistoric monsters or dinosaurs, prehistoric monsters or dinosaurs, but just some type of lost civilizations like von Daniken, my hero, Eric von Daniken.
Caller one, do you have any response to that question?
I don't.
So, I mean, what are you exploring in the Amazon? Is it just simply cutting through the jungle with the machete, or is there some particular thing that you're looking for there?
You know, there is no goal in sight. The other side of me is just cutting his way through the Amazon, going down the river on the left, and I think it's just that he's very adventurous. I mean, I don't know what goal he has, but at least I haven't found a goal.
Well, my suggestion for you would be to think about what goals you have in your own existence that are unfulfilled.
Right.
In your everyday Boston existence, and try to transfer some of that energy from that Amazonian explorer to the Boston self, and let it infuse a new search within your current self.
Hmm. Oh, fuck, my boss is coming.
I suppose it's dangerous to call in radio shows from airplanes.
And let us state once more that while you remain on the air, please do be courteous. There are children listening.
Not least of our childlike minds. And is Scott still with us?
Yeah. I'm sorry that I actually called while another caller. I imposed upon you.
Absolutely not.
No, I find it interesting that you mentioned Eric von Daniken.
Lee. Yes.
Who, I believe, has many theories regarding how our ancient civilizations evolved and the possible input of alien civilizations.
Sometimes the Mayas, sometimes older civilizations, or any civilization that he might have missed. Kenneth Clark is the other civilization person.
Hmm.
Well, again, going back to this story about sleep, which I mentioned, in these kinds of pre-electricity civilizations, sleep was conducted in a different way. In fact, life itself was conducted in an entirely different way. So one would go to sleep as soon as the sun set and sleep for maybe 5 or 6 hours, then awake again, conduct some activity, some nocturnal activity in the middle of the night, perhaps eat, and then one would go back to sleep again until the morning. So instead of one concentrated burst of sleep the way we do it now, sleep would be more evenly divided throughout the day. And I think life in general was more diffuse.
You could actually take the shower before, or the bath that you were thinking of, you could take that before going to bed and actually mellow out your sleeping.
Yeah, mellowing, yeah.
If you actually took your bubble?
Without the yeah. Anthrax, yes.
And then, like, you know, make a soft, mellow adventure.
I believe this does take us back to Eric Von Däniken, for his beliefs that the aliens would travel back in time and infuse us slowly.
The Aryans?
No, aliens.
Aliens?
Yes.
Oh.
The extraterrestrials.
Extraterrestrials. Eric Von Däniken's his book, Chariots of the Gods, where he takes the great strides in ancient civilizations and explains them through alien intervention, which he says is taken slowly so as not to elevate humans in one giant leap as we sleep in the Western world in one giant packet, but to give short bursts
and many problems,
of development.
Many mysteries and problems can be solved easily if even brief time travel is possible.
If taken short, continuous leaps.
Well, besides sleeping, of course, these kinds of civilizations also thought of their lives in a very different way. In fact, one can measure the degree to which one lives within the moment, the present, versus focusing on future long-term achievements and goals. And I think here in the U.S. and in the West in general, in our modern age, we're very focused on the future all the time, what the future will bring, how will we achieve our goals. But in these pre-modern civilizations, there was less concern about long-term goals and more of a focus on the present moment.
Well, this, I believe, goes back to the joint curse and blessing of the developments of agriculture and the industrial and electrical revolutions, for as we have more time to think, so have we gained the spiritual lens, which before was merely a sheet of beautiful glass. And so this lens focuses us into the future, into a time which we cannot perceive for a very, very long time.
But I would argue that by focusing so much on the future, we miss out on the experience, which is life itself.
Exactly. Exactly. When our spiritual eyes are focused so far away, they cannot point deep inwards.
And I've mentioned this before, but I found one of the greatest, deepest pleasures in my life is focusing on the feeling of my heels as they hit the ground as I walk. This walking sensation and the focus on the physical impact of my feet on the ground and the smell of the air. These kinds of things can be the most spiritually amazing experiences one can ever undergo.
I found that it can be rewarding to temporarily reinvent oneself for a short period of time, to wear the wrong clothes, to live in the wrong apartment, to eat the wrong food, to speak with the wrong people.
Unfortunately, this does often end up landing one in jail a bit for a period of time. I advise people before they do this to get the consent of the person who they are now inhabiting, so that they are not arrested for breaking and entering and so on, and theft of the food and the clothing.
Or to simply reinvent oneself as a visitor. A visitor, just as one is a visitor to existence.
Hmm. Wasn't that what travel is all about? One becomes a new person because no one knows you, where you are. And so you are a visitor rather than someone grounded and anchored in your everyday existence.
Well, I could say that there is some aspect of that, but for me, travel is an opportunity to see in the perception of others in order to better understand myself and the reasons behind the things I do, to better separate my cultural and societal brainwashing and overcome it and see my true inner self. So as you distance yourself from yourself, so can you bring yourself much, much closer.
To yourself.
To yourself. To understanding.
And it is all about creating a deeper sense of self. A lot of the exploratory enterprise.
But eventually,
the final destination.
The self does come to an end.
And what happens in the post-self?
The self does not itself come to an end. It only becomes part of a larger, broader sense of the self.
Well, it becomes part of the whole.
Exactly.
But if you'd like to become part of the whole here, the number is 617-253-8810. Caller 3, marhaban.
Namaste.
Marhaban, I believe this is Arthur.
Arthur here.
Welcome, Arthur.
Yeah, it's been a voyage.
It has. Tell us about the journey. Tell us if you have engineered within yourself a greater sense of yourself.
Yeah, well, the physical journey has been in one place in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Been doing silent meditation and ashram there for several months. It's been a while.
And is this a Christian, evangelical Christian form of meditation?
No, they're there also.
I see. So many forms of spiritual growth are occurring in Colorado Springs.
Yeah, I've never encountered Christian or ashrams, but they probably exist.
Non-denominational. Let's bring another voice in to share the journey here with us, Arthur. Caller 4, marhaban.
Hello?
Yes. Caller.
Oh, hello.
Welcome, caller. So, caller, tell us about your journey.
It's a long journey, I guess. Every day we get up, we go to work, and we get caught up in these ruts of life, you know, but sometimes I feel like life becomes so surreal. You know, it's like, what am I doing? What am I supposed to be doing? Am I supposed to be just doing the same thing every day? Am I supposed to, you know, pay my bills and you know, I guess it just gets very overwhelming if you start to step out of yourself for a minute and realize there's so much out there. There's so many other things I could be doing.
Caller, I agree with you completely, and you seem to be dealing with a great life congestion at the moment. And there are times when we do need to pause and build ourselves in order to achieve the great freedom that we so desire. But at other times, we need to break away from those chains which are holding us down.
I think,
yes.
Caller, it's interesting because the way you speak about your life is as a piece, a small component of a machine with a goal to produce, but there is no satisfaction for each piece of the machine. And how does one break free? Is it right to live outside of the machine?
Yes. Is it, you know, it's funny to me because I noticed more when I became a father, which was just 3 years ago, that these things started really becoming more frequent, these types of feelings. Like, I'm sorry, I don't know the woman's name, said freedom. That's exactly what I'm talking about. The freedom to really, really enjoy life.
But have you found that since becoming a father, you've been able to infuse the simple things in life with a new kind of joy?
Not as much as I'd like to, I'm afraid.
It's a difficult thing to do, I think. It's very difficult.
It is very difficult. It's, you know, because I think of my son, and you know, everything is so, it's so easy for him in a sense, because a child is just, they just want to be loved, and I remember that feeling as a child myself. You know, you just want to feel safe and loved and comforted, and then you realize, you know, now being a 34-year-old man, I look back and I say, I remember those feelings, and now I'm providing them for him, but I don't want him to become 34 and feel like he's not free. He's, you know, stuck in some career and just the mechanics of life every day, of just getting up and doing the things that need to be done to put the roof over the head. And
Color, you make such a valiant point, and there are two ways that you can make an example for him to prevent him from falling in the same rut as you. And one way is for you to break away from your life as it is and build yourself into a happier whole. And the other way is to remain in this rut so that he may see what might happen to him.
To serve as an example.
Exactly.
Well, that's a very stark view. I think the key sometimes is perspective. So yeah. I think it's not necessary to radically change all the details of one's everyday existence. The key is to infuse those things with perspective and joy of life itself. And I know that's a very difficult thing, but I found that even a little bit of time thinking and meditating can really clear one's mind of this debris that modern life kind of shoves into it. And it can allow you to get back to the simple joys of holding your son, of getting up in the morning, of going to sleep at night. These are all amazingly great pleasures.
Well, absolutely, sure.
Now, I would right. like to offer a third view, and perhaps even a fourth view. One thing that we have spoken about earlier, many, many weeks ago on the program, is the economic system that we are living in. In particular, it is an economic system that is predicated on scarcity. The idea that we all are competing for food and competing for the opportunity to reproduce. So it seems to me that there was some simplicity of an earlier time which we have lost. And I wonder if by reevaluating these axioms, it is possible to find a system where we are able to recover that simplicity. And maybe it is by continuing to work until the possibility of scarcity becomes comical. But maybe it is simply by evaluating what we already possess.
Well, I think for myself that we will get there. I think it's sort of by fits and starts or moving in the direction of humans being able to have the time and the peace of mind to reflect on what's really important. Because if you actually realize this, hundreds of years ago when people were peasants, they had no time at all to think about their life. They were in a very serious rut. That was a rut for humanity for hundreds of years, where the average existence of the regular person was backbreaking labor from sunup to sundown.
But before that, earlier, when our core psyches were being evolved, we lived in an environment where there were brief periods of fear, of struggle, but generally there was plenty food.
Yes.
But
of course, that only was able to support maybe several thousand human beings on this earth. I do think that because of the march of technology, we're actually now entering an era where it might be possible to regain that kind of sense of peace.
Well, let me refer to the words of the ancient philosopher Xuan Gu, who said that introspection and reflection upon one's value and what one should be doing in life is like trying to see the back of one's head through the reflection of a river, and that one's face will always get in the way, the face representing the self's desires.
And I wonder if Arthur is still there. Let's bring another voice in. If anyone would like to call in, it's 617-253-8810. Caller, welcome.
Bonjour.
Welcome back, Arthur.
Had some perception problems there with the sound for a minute.
Well, I think we all have some perception problems. perception problems in our life. We think we see a river, but it is simply the hot air of the desert shimmering in our face.
It's good to hear that sound resound on the physical cell mind.
It is really wonderful. And is the father caller with us also? So I think we've lost the call.
Okay, well, he's probably still listening. I have my own take on that. Now,
please, Arthur.
One of the things I got at the silent ashram, I mean, you're spending so much time just thinking and letting your mind expand, and you become much more in tune with the sun rising and falling. I just get tired a lot, especially in the winter when the sun goes down pretty quick. When it's dark outside and you're not thinking about much of anything, you just want to go to sleep, you know? And you get these bimodal sleep patterns that emerge, very common in medieval times, not just in one place, but all across the world, where you go to sleep when the sun goes down, but that's really early in the day, so you're going to wake up in the middle of the night, and that's a time for family, a time for communing, time for lovers, and that's going to last maybe until, you know, 3 in the morning, and then you go back to sleep and get up at sunrise. These bimodal sleep distributions have actually made all the difference in my life. It's just another example where you wonder if industry technology is progress. A lot of times it is, but it's taking you further and further away from, you know, who we really are as people, so you always kind of have to call it into context also.
Well, and Arthur, I love this point, because I often have felt that spirituality was directly opposed and faced a lot of conflict with the existence of humanity as a force of building. And I think my favorite example of this is the Jewish Sabbath, which I think Professor Levine here can speak to. But I have this image of a great machine at one point in time attempting to build pyramids and cubes and other geometrical objects, and the Jews saying, "Sorry, I cannot build. I have been ordered spiritually to abstain."
Right, and of course, the story of the Sabbath in the scriptures comes from the idea that God Himself has a day of abstention from work. So this is sort of a reflection of our image as being created in the image of God. And I think part of New Age philosophy really does emphasize this idea that each individual human is an image of God, and that whatever needs we have are some sort of reflection of universal needs and sparks of divinity.
So perhaps all of us should spend time in building our own little universes, 6 days out of seven.
It's paradoxical, because what if you could build a Sabbath machine? Right,
a machine that creates the Sabbath. Well, of course, modern Orthodox religious Jews do this sort of thing all the time. There are special Sabbath lights, and this is a light. Of course, turning off and on light bulbs is forbidden, as is starting fires. So, so the solution that some people have come up with is to, well, first have timers. So set the timers before the Sabbath to automatically turn the lights off and on, according to some preset schedule. But that, you lose some flexibility there. You have to sort of plan out the next 24 hours, saying, I'll be waking up at this time, reading for this time, going to sleep at this time.
Now, does the timer need to be set up by someone who is not Jewish?
No, anyone can set the timer up, as long as it is set up before the Sabbath begins.
But if you are setting up a timer that goes on and off every day, are you not setting it on the Sabbath day itself as well?
Well, it's the actual, I guess, the proximate effect of the human being is just simply setting the timer in place. And that setting in place occurs not during the Sabbath. So that's
Aurora, the analogy there would imply that food prepared not on the Sabbath could not be eaten on the Sabbath, that a house that was built not on the Sabbath could not be inhabited.
I did want to make one other point regarding something that Arthur mentioned about this idea of this bimodal sleep distribution, where the middle of the night is some intimate time for the family and loved ones. In some Jewish mystical traditions, mystics would awake in the middle of the night for several hours and lament the destruction of the temple and our loss of the divinity of God being present in our lives. So it's sort of almost the flip side of this, where it's almost a sad time. It's a time to inject some sort of principled sorrow into our lives, with the idea being that this kind of sorrow can actually enrich us in some way, allow us to experience the full spectrum of human emotions.
Kind of a productive sorrow and reflection.
That's right, yeah. So it would be a very serious time in the middle of the night. And in particular, that midnight hour was considered a very auspicious time for beseeching God for things. So that's when one would lament sort of the lack of presence of the divine in our lives and pray to God to bring the divine back into our lives. It's the time of redemption.
It's also a way to stay in touch with the seasons. You know, it combines with modern times. If you're in Alaska in the summer and want to play baseball at 11 p.m., you know, that's the flip side. That's great.
Yes, these kinds of observances help us keep our life and our time kind of focused, and I myself find that when I have a wife or a girlfriend, the menstrual cycle helps me stay in touch with temporal existence, with things going on in time. But when I'm not with a female, when I'm not with a woman, and I lose that menstrual cycle, I feel unmoored from time itself.
The menstrual cycle is for everybody. It's for all genders.
Indeed it is so. Although I would hazard to say
that it is horrible for the woman much more than it is for the man.
Well, my own feeling is that the rising and setting sun moors me within time better than...
But that's just one day. This is a month's unit, so we get this intermediate unit between the day and the season.
Perhaps the observation of the full moon could keep you in tune.
If one is a werewolf, yes.
Or the changing weather.
Changing weather, yes, but that's continuous.
I'm talking about discrete
markers, which say a month has passed since the last memory I have of this event.
Well, I always wait for the street cleaning announcement to come on my road. Mm-hmm. The cars, they make an announcement. Street cleaning, move yourself. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the joys of urban existence, I guess. One can mark one's time by street sweeping schedules.
Precisely, and the street sweepers in my region have become accustomed to the rituals that I perform when I hear their announcements.
In my, I live in Somerville, and I don't hear any announcements, but I actually do hear the machine itself sweeping down my street. And when I hear that sound, it occurs a little after midnight because the schedule starts then. I say, oh yes, it is now Tuesday.
Well, it is on a monthly basis where I live, and you hear the announcement, street cleaning, cars parked on the even number side will be tagged and towed, over and over again in this lovely trumpeting serenade of welcome to the new month.
And for me, also, the rituals then become dependent on the season, because, of course, in the winter season, the rituals must cease. The sweepers no longer come, and it is in my own view, which is centered on the sweeper schedule, it becomes a long month.
Now, Arthur, your sleeping patterns, do you suggest it merely for the winter months or for year-round enjoyment?
Well, mostly comes into effect in the winter, but my recommendation is to just let it go, you know, get rid of that alarm clock if you can, just go to sleep when it feels right, try to go to sleep when the sun goes down, and then wake up at whatever time's right. It puts into our circadian rhythm.
Now, do you use electrical lights in your life?
Well, I try to avoid it in the bedroom, but electrical lights, monitors, those can have an effect on the rhythm, right?
Yeah, I find candles to be a much better source of natural light for me. It somehow, electrical lights have a sort of raise tension in my body, whereas the soft light of the candle allows me to calm down after the stress of the day.
Helium lamps are also very nice, as they slowly turn on as they warm up.
And if you don't have candles,
mercury just, lamps, not helium.
And just the stovetop burner, that works
right,
also.
Or fireflies.
Or indeed fire.
Fire, yes.
Yeah, fire.
Which is a candle, I believe.
I just turn on the gas fire on the stovetop, and electrical works as well. You can kind of get that heated orange glow.
I mean, I want to also step back and, I mean, fire is not only from a candle or from, I mean, anything can be made into a fire.
Yeah.
Except for a large bucket of water.
It's possible. But we will
it
not.
Is possible.
We are unfortunately at the hour has been lit on the fire also.
Got it. Time to douse the fire.
It is, unfortunately. But Arthur, it's so wonderful to have been with you, even for this brief time.
Good to be back. Good to be back on my feet.
And hopefully we will continue to hear from you. Ma'asalama. And ma'asalama, of course, to Aurora.
Namaste.
And to Professor Levine here.
Goodbye.
Thanks to our many callers this evening. This is Dr. Jalis Sakran here on Music for Human. Music for Human is on every Friday at 7 p.m. on WMBR Cambridge 88.1 FM. Stay tuned for Hipster Happy Hour. Ma'asalama.
Safety.
Number one,
cars and bikes stop at red lights.
It's against the law for car drivers or bicycle riders to ignore traffic signals.
So don't buzz through red lights. There might be a pedestrian or turning car that doesn't see you coming.
Number two,
look first before you open your door.
Numerous bicyclists have been injured or even killed by car doors suddenly opening into them.
Look first, and bicyclists, stay out of the door zone.
Number three,
cross with the signal.
You are safest if you wait for a walk or green traffic signal.
Don't jaywalk. That's just walking into trouble.
Number four,
cars and bikes should stop for pedestrians in unsignalized crosswalks.
Be nice. Be legal. Be safe.
Brought to you as a public service by the Cambridge Bicycle Committee and this station.
Not gonna lie to you, I am sick, it's been a long week, I am sleep-depped, but I am here, and that's, you know, I'm just that dedicated to the show. That, and I live virtually a 30-second walk away from the radio station, but the important thing is that I am here, and I have some great music for you tonight, and also some concert tickets I'll be giving away later in the show, so stay tuned for that. But right now, coming up first, we have a track by Les Savvy Fav, which is a band I just recently realized existed, off of their album Inches, which I could really just play that whole CD for this show. That is how good that CD is.